invited myself over here, he invited me to speak. And now for the second account of the four Gospels. That was one of the best sermonettes I've heard in a long time, I told my wife. I should like, since we have a little time that this national holiday, as well as God's holy day, to take just a bit of time on the subject that he mentioned, since I used to teach for many years the area of the background of the Old and New Testament. I would draw attention to a few things that I could add here that might help you understand a little more of material. Probably the simpler way that I would do it to remember would be to think of them all in terms of the function of Christ, if you wanted to. That is, Matthew certainly addresses Christ as the King, and Mark as the servant, and Luke as the Son of Man, and John as the Son of God. What I wanted to mention is that Matthew's account, which we now have in an original form in Greek, was initially, according to the Greek traditions, and in this sense what we are saying is that many of the traditions of the Greek Orthodox Church, with the Greek customs and rites, go back to knowledge that was preserved in the Greek world among many people who became absorbed in that congregation, whose ancestors were members at one time or another of the Church of God in the Greek world. Their tradition is, of course, that Matthew was first written in Hebrew. Now it is logical, if Matthew did write the Gospel first, which I hold to be the case, that's why it's first there, that he would not have addressed it to the Jews in Greek. He would have addressed it to the Jews in Hebrew. And there was no decision at that time what should be what we call the preserved Word of God, the canon of Scripture, or in what language, other than the logical language in which Scripture had always been written, which is Hebrew up to this time. The question, of course, is were the Jews going to preserve it, connection with the law, the prophets, and the writing. At a later time, maybe half a dozen years or so, I am not giving any specific chronological account at this point, there was a need, of course, to reach the Hellenic Jews, or the Hellenistic speaking Jews who were living in the area of Antioch in Syria. That is, as the word grew, we were not merely reaching people whose general knowledge of Hebrew was sufficient for the church to understand the gospel in Hebrew, the Aramaic was the language of the people, Palestine, but there was the need to have that message written among people of whom we read in the book of Acts who were Hellenistic Jews. Jews living in the Greek-speaking areas where Greek rather than Aramaic was certainly the common language of the day. It is my conclusion that the first gospel written in Greek, therefore, was Mark, but it was the second gospel written. Now, the necessity of writing something like this in Greek became obvious. But it was not addressed to Greeks. That should be very plain, because it is assuming all kinds of knowledge. Matthew doesn't assume a knowledge background. He starts out with a genealogy that links the New with the Old Testament. He starts out with a great deal of background material in chapter 1 and 2 of Jesus, whereas Mark plunges right into the story of John the Baptist, as if everybody knew of the events of the time. Because he's not doing something original, he's not writing to a people without knowledge. He's clearly writing to Jews, but in a Greek milieu. Now when we come to Luke, interestingly, Luke goes back in the traditional Greek fashion and addresses the people in the Greek world. Didn't exclude Jews, but most certainly emphasized Greeks, whose background is Greek. we have an introduction here. There were a number of leaders. There was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a high priest named Zacharias. And now he gives the historic setting from a political point of view and fills in many details. We can go on, I'll just illustrate the point. And it came to pass in those days there was a decree of Augustus Caesar, a reference here fundamentally to the world in which the Greeks lived and moved. Now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Luke 3 was, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, Herod was tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip tetrarch of Iturea, and the region of Trachonitis, and Lysanias was the tetrarch of Abilene. And there were individuals in the high priesthood. All of this is clearly something that any Greek could check in terms of the official functioning of the Roman government. And again, as was mentioned, when all of those gospel accounts were finished, there were many customs in the Church of God that had not yet been incorporated in any gospel, and there is no doubt that John writes from the point of view of filling in those details, using as a framework the next annual holy days and time setting. But he does something very interesting. By this time, the world of Asia, shall we say, the mysteries of the East, had become very commonplace. John is certainly writing hardly earlier than approximately 80 A.D. in the Gospel account, or in that period of time, is my general view. And I don't mean to say that I have made any in-depth study of it, because I'm still looking for some very interesting information on the Institute of Others. But he writes it from the point of view of people who are involved in philosophy and involved in speculation, where the whole world was in religious ferment. So he starts out, in the beginning was the word, a mystery word anyway. You can call it a noun or a verb, whatever you want, but it has a sense in Latin and verbal of a word of action. In the Greek logos, something of expression. In German and English, it means a word, just like we say it, which is a very peculiar form. And if you were addressing the English language, this would be the last thing we would ever use to define Jesus with. But it was a term that was very common by this time in the Greek and Roman world as a result of philosophy of the East. And the word was with God, the word was God, light shining out of darkness. Those things illustrate the background of the material. And God did choose to have different themes in each one of the accounts. He chose also to have different purposes in each one's being written in the very first place. And I would not draw the conclusion that these were the only four accounts ever written. You don't know any other information than that the four have been preserved. But I wouldn't draw the conclusion either that certainly Mark or Luke were necessarily thinking of Scripture when they wrote it. You will notice the introduction that Luke uses here, if I may explain. Now, only Matthew and Mark wrote up to this time. I challenge you to explain the following verse. For as much as many have taken in hand to set forth in order a declaration of those things which are most surely believed among us. Now, if he had said, for as much as two have taken in hand, then you might say we have some basis for only four ever being written. Even as they delivered them to us, which from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, it seemed good to me also, in addition to the many, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, for being in the profession he was, he must have had access to facts and libraries, that although he was not one of the 12, he certainly was able to convey certain information that was very important to the Greek world. Mark was not one of the 12, Luke was not one of the 12, Matthew and John were. So much for what I think is a very enlightened approach to taking a look at some books of the Bible. Now, since sometimes a Sabbath falls on a unique day, such as this pagan day, I think it would be good for us to adopt a practice on occasion, as with Christmas of this past year, and it is past, that you do take in hand the responsibility to examine how New Year's became January 1. That's an interesting way to put it, because New Year's was not previously January 1. I think any person going to school, any boy or girl, should have some knowledge of these things in an encyclopedia. You don't have to read our literature on the subject to find the answer, maybe a guide, but go to the encyclopedia that might be available in your local school or public library. You will discover some very interesting things. That Christmas didn't used to be on December 25th. It's on January 6th. New Year's was not on January 1. It was earlier or later in the year. If you were even to take note of the fact that the early documents for about 125 years since the founding of the British colonies on the East Coast, what we now think is the United States, New Year's was not even January 1. Hence the controversy of the year in which George Washington was born, because of the change of calendar afterward. If you consider that the Christmas tree was not a custom among the English-speaking peoples of the New World until after the War of Independence, commemorated 200 years ago, or this year as 200 years ago, and that it really didn't spread throughout Germany until the 1800s, and not throughout the rest of the Christian world and non-Christian world till the 1850s, you will understand that ancient traditions sometimes nearly disappear and then are born again, so to speak, of the flesh. Now it is appropriate to extend publicly the very best wishes and appreciation of my wife and of myself to Mr. and Mrs. Kendall in the second row, or he's in the second row, but your wife just stepped away with the baby. We had a very pleasant Sabbath some few weeks ago en route to Visalia and Fresno, and we stayed at their home in Lancaster, which of course is a delightful area of Western United States. It's a beautiful region. I thought traveling through Tehachapi on the way to Visalia was one of the most beautiful areas I have been in. I want to mention that the Ambassador College Library has acquired a book whose title you should know. It was published in 1976, and probably its title is the most significant of any written on the subject, which would have laid to rest some doubts in the ministry, certainly outside of the ministry, and generally speaking in those who left, who questioned that Mr. Armstrong had any understanding of prophecy with respect to the beast, etc., in Revelation chapter 13 or 17, and also in Daniel. Written by an Englishman, the only English historian accepted by Italians as able to write Italian history. The book is entitled Mussolini's Roman Empire, published in 1976. If any of you happen to be in Pasadena, our library has it. Most likely most public libraries do not. I would suggest if they don't have it, you might look in the books in print, which would be in the reference section of the library. Find the title for 1976, Mussolini's Roman Empire, the author and publisher, and take it to the reference library and say, I want this book. politely, but firmly. Now maybe it already has the book, I do not know, but it is a relatively new one. And I am pleased to say that the title itself spares you the reading of the rest of it. I would have had my copy here, but when I visited George Meeker, Feature Trumpets, I left him a gift of the book in appreciation of his feeding me and bedding me down there. We didn't have to have any other expenses. Yesterday I received a book copyrighted in 1977. It's not a mystery. It's only the fact that it was in my hands in advance of the time it normally appears in the bookstores. I'm very grateful in that sense. In terms of your ability to read material, to mention to you that Dr. Emanuel Velikovsky has come out with the last, as well as the first volume in his series on Ages and Chaos, titled Peoples of the Sea. I want to mention this very briefly, because you can read it. It will certainly be in the bookstore. Doubleday publishes, Doubleday advertises, and knows how. Therefore, you can find your own copy of this one with ease. Peoples of the Sea is the story of the 20th and 21st dynasties of Egypt. The 20th dynasty is the period of Ramses III, who is assumed to be contemporary with the period of Saul, or before, that is approximately that period. The dynasty is assumed to have paralleled the time of the Philistines. In the book of Judges, and in early Samuel, in the time of Saul, and the 21st dynasty is assumed to have reached the period of David to Solomon. And the peoples of the sea are assumed to be the Philistines who had settled on the coast of Palestine in the days of the Judges. So much for the general accepted view. I, of course, for years have mentioned what the real story is. The Philistines were there before Abraham. They were there in the days of Abraham and Isaac, many centuries before the peoples of the sea migrated along the coast. In fact, the peoples of the sea were the Greeks who were hired by the Persians to attack Egypt. And Ramses III was a contemporary of the late kings. First dynasty high priests. Among them was a man who led Alexander the Great to the oasis where he was told that his father was indeed Zeus, Amun. And all of this material is laid out very clearly. The tombs of any number of these people were assigned by historians to the period of the Philistines. And because it looked so much like the Greeks, they thought the Philistines were in some way Mycenaean Greeks. The Philistines in the Bible spoke Hebrew or a Semitic language. They did not speak an Indo-European. But these facts do not deter historians from inventing explanations of the impossible. I think it is a very interesting thing to recognize that a man has been able, now he is 80 years of age, to complete this volume, and I have recommended the Ages of Chaos. I do not find that everything that is said is correct in any one of these books from the point of view of the fact that he does not take the Bible as the starting point. He does take the Bible as a fundamental reference, therefore he has much greater advantage. Velikovsky is a Jew of some prominence. His father was very prominent in the founding of this, let's say, Hebrew University and the culture of the Hebrew people in Palestine. I have met Dr. Velikovsky and his wife and daughter, Dr. Velikovsky and his wife on a number of occasions. He would view me as a fundamentalist in the sense that I take the Bible for what it says, that manna came from God rather than the planet Venus. I think it's better to eat from God's hand than Venus's. Apart from some of those speculations, I would have to say without a question that this book, which happens to be $10, is very significant in terms of a restoration of the historical perspective of the Old Testament. I don't believe I paid that much, but that's what it will probably cost. I cannot take the time to have all of you order copies, but if you wish, and one of you wants to do so, I can tell you how you can get your copies for no more than that. That is, you don't have to pay tax or postage, which is a saving. If you want to collect a list of the number of people who are interested, I can order a group of books for you, if some of you would like it, let's say half a dozen or a dozen. And the cost is $10 flat, to my knowledge. I think that's what I paid, which includes postage and everything else. And we could have them available for those of you who have read in the area. I am grateful that we also have the pictures coming from the British Museum, which is very important. The problem was how to explain some of the mysteries of Ramses III in the days of the Philistines, the days of the judges of Saul, where you have on the back of the tiles used in his buildings Greek lettering of the 4th century. All of this has been laid aside as something impossible to explain. Greek lettering of the 4th century were mere symbols of those who had prepared the tiles for his public building. And indeed, that's the period of time when he lived, when we see the whole picture. They are given here in print from the British Museum. I think that was one of the remarkable things that historians for over 70 years have been unwilling to face. But it is very common, of course, for human beings that are out of the church. We are, as human beings, very prone to lay aside strong evidence that needs to be considered that might alter one's view. Now, I should like to mention that there are a few who were attending the morning services in Pasadena who might be attending over here in Reseda. Some might have gone to Glendora, others might have gone to the two Glendale churches or Long Beach or Santa Ana. Some might just find it's very difficult to travel, so the elderly might stay at home. And some will be going this afternoon to the massive mess of paper. They'll be scattered through Pasadena, which I guess is one way to celebrate New Year's. It's a filthy town the day of the parade. Do take a great deal of effort to clean it up the following day or two. I thought it was the most horrid sight I'd ever seen in my life when I first witnessed the Rose Parade in Pasadena. But anyway, a few brethren came here. This is a little distance and would at least certainly extend on behalf of the local staff here and all you brethren greetings. If you do not know everyone, you might become acquainted. For those of you who are normally here and do not spot an individual as one who's traditional from the congregation, please get acquainted. I think that would be appropriate on an occasion such as this. And many things have happened since I was here last, and I will just extend a few thoughts and words of greeting, especially from South Africa and the South Pacific. A year ago in October, of course, I had the privilege of being at the Feast of Trumpets with our brethren in Tonga. Shortly afterward, with the brethren in Fiji and in Australia. On the Day of Atonement, being with the brethren in Mauritius and the Feast of Tabernacles in South Africa, where we met a very fine group. We had the main festival site in Victoria. We also had a chance to visit two sites on the southeast coast of Africa and Georgia on the south. The area where the colored were was in Cape Town, the whites were in George, the whites were in Pretoria, the blacks and Indians were at a very undeveloped site, which I loved the best of all, at Umgababa, which is an appropriate name, I guess. I want to mention that one of our own members is the Director of Agriculture at the New Republic of the Transkei. One of our church members who had a Bible study with me in Pasadena introduced me to two members of the cabinet of the government of South Africa, and thereafter Mr. Henny Smith of Railbonanda Colored Affairs invited my wife and me to visit Southwest Africa, which we did this past May. One of the members of the 11 population groups at the constitutional meetings that have been going on in Bintoki, the capital of Southwest Africa, twice written me, expressing in one case his appreciation of the first article when he had not yet read the second. There was a basic applause of the approach of the magazine as expressed in those two articles throughout the Republic of South Africa, for which I am grateful. I tried to make it simple. I tried to make it plain as to what responsibility the great nations are in a situation like this. Mr. and Mrs. Wasserfall, he's not converted, she is, are members in Bintoki. Mrs. Wasserfall is a noted artist in Southwest Africa. I had a chance to meet the director of the museum as well as a number of the political officials that I mentioned. We had a chance also to visit with a brother of one of the members who is in the white opposition in Rhodesia. He told many of the inside, shall I say, tales or stories of the events in Rhodesia itself. I would like you to keep your mind off this part of the world. A great deal of pressure is being brought to bear on Rhodesia and Southwest Africa. Break these two countries down, refusal by the United Nations to recognize the Transkei, which has achieved independence in peace, though it is economically dependent on Southwest Africa, as most third world nations are dependent on others. But since it happened in peace and not by war, as Angola or Mozambique, it should not be recognized. And that, of course, is the stupid thinking of the United Nations. But I think we need to see the total world perspective for what it is. Angola wouldn't even have a government now if it weren't for Cuban troops there. But that's the situation. From South Africa, Mr. Armstrong wrote a co-worker letter dated the 19th of November, which has precipitated many comments. Would you please explain it again? It wasn't quite clear, and I thought it appropriate, whether some few of you heard my explanation before, perhaps to give it from a slightly different style, a point of view, but I should like to comment on it, since I think it is important for us to see it. It will be a very slightly revised form, and hopefully clearer, therefore, just a few words or phrases or sentences at most can clear up sometimes certain things that are not altogether clear. If you have Mr. Herbert Armstrong had a chance to read it, let's say from a telex, it might have been resolved a little better, but we could always comment later. This is in reference to his statements regarding the 11th and the 10th chapters of the Book of Revelation, the work that he is doing. And I will try to explain where some of the problems arose, if there were doubts as to the meaning, what Mr. Armstrong may or may not have emphasized. Maybe he didn't spot everything. His explanation might vary slightly, but I do not have any doubt in my mind that if we would sit down and talk, the reason it was unclear is that there was one fundamental word that he did not emphasize, which had he done so would probably have made it clear. And it would certainly then have been easier for him to have clarified it. some of our brethren wrote and said, now I know, Mr. Armstrong, you really want us to understand it because you took so many pages to write it, but could you please explain? Now, one of the misunderstandings that was utterly unfounded was that Mr. Armstrong was saying that we were reaching peoples and tongues and nations and kings for 3.5 years since 1972, and how come we're in 76 and it's only 3.5 years? I don't think everybody stumbled on that, but a sufficient number did, because they didn't even read carefully. So it brings to my attention that sometimes an author can neglect to emphasize that which is most important, that people very often read ideas into a chapter. But Mr. Chet Armstrong has not grasped the picture as his father sees it. He rather looks at it much as probably the majority of church members did at the time they read the co-worker letter. I will say that, generally speaking, in our literature, we had viewed chapter 10 in the book of Revelation as in some way connected with the sixth trumpet, the sixth angel it sounds in chapter 9, verse 13. In chapter 9, verse 13, the sixth angel sounds, and then there comes chapter 10, and then there is chapter 11 through verse 13. And then the second woe, it says, is past, and the third woe comes quickly, and the seventh angel sounded, and that's, of course, the time of the resurrection, when the nations are angry, verse 18, and their wrath has come in the time of the dead, that they should be judged, which is an incorrect translation. It's the time of the nations, which is the proper rendering of the Byzantine Greek. It is not the time of the dead that they should be judged. That's 1,000 years later. It's the time of the nations that they should be judged, and that you should give reward to your servants, the prophets, and to the saints who are not included in this period of the time of the judgment of the nation. So the word dead should be stricken. That is an erroneous rendering. The proper meaning is nations, and there isn't any doubt that the Greeks have it right. And you should destroy those who destroy the earth. Now we used to understand, of course, that Revelation 11, verses 1 through 13, was an insect. That is, that sometimes in writing a story, much as Velikovsky has done it, he has written a story of this period from Persia through Alexander to the Ptolemies, and then he goes back and tells the whole story again from another point of view. Now, in the same way, we recognize that by the time you are in the sounding of the sixth trumpet, you only have one more to go, which is the resurrection. And very clearly, chapter 11, the first 13 verses, is not something that takes place between the sixth trumpet and the seventh trumpet, but rather is an inset that fills in the story of what is taking place with respect to the church, the ministry, near the close of the work. And it is for a 3.5 year period that we have reference here in chapter 11, the first 13 verses. Now this inset, we did recognize as occurring, but our assumption was that all of chapter 10 was a continuation of the sixth trumpet, the sixth angel that sounds this trumpet, sixth in sequence. What we did not recognize, of course, is how an inset chapter begins. Thus, chapter 12 begins in a unique way. Just take a quick note. There appeared a great wonder in heaven. Chapter 13, verse 1. There is a beast that rises out of the sea. That's another inset in the sequence. It goes way back into history. Chapter 13, verse 11 is another inset, and I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth. And we could go on. I saw in chapter 15 a sign in heaven. And then you clearly have chapter 17. There was one of the seven angels which had seven vials, and he talked with me and said, I will show you the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth had committed porneia. And so he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-covered beast. And then in chapter 18, another inset going back to show the whole economic system. And after these things, I saw another angel come down. And he showed me this Babylonian system in all its economic perspective, just like Revelation 17 has its perspective historically. But if you read carefully in chapter 11, verse 1, it just says, "And there was given me a reed like a rod, and the angel stood, saying, Rise and measure the temple of God." And it's right in the middle of the thought, which is what we did not carefully take note of. We were focusing in on the rest of the chapter so much, we didn't note that chapter 11, verse 1, does not introduce the inset, but is only in the middle of an inset, which ends with verse 13. And in fact, the inset begins with chapter 10, verse 1. "And I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head, and his face was as it were that of the sun, his feet as pillars of fire. And he had a little book open, and he set his right foot on the sea and the left on the earth." Now at this point, we begin to see a major introduction, much like the story of this woman in chapter 12, a great marvelous sign in the heavens. So what we did not see before, because we could not understand it in the earlier days of this work, was that this is an inset chapter, of which 11 is only a part and not the only inset. Let's get that clearly in mind then. To say that chapter 10 has to be in the day of the Lord merely because it follows the sixth angel blowing the sixth trumpet would be to say that therefore chapter 11 verses 1 to 13 must also be, which of course is not the case, because there you have a picture quite different in terms of what is going to take place when you compare that with Daniel. And if we can have an inset for 13 verses in chapter 11, you can just as well have an inset earlier. And when you see how the two chapters are bridged, let's look at the end of chapter 10. "Now I took this little book," says John, "out of the angel's hands and ate it up, and it was in my mouth sweet as honey. And as soon as I had eaten it, my belly was bitter. Now he said to me, you must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings. And there was given me a reed like unto a rod. And the angel stood saying," and obviously the angel in chapter 11, verse 1, is the same one who was there in chapter 10, verses 10 and 11. It goes right on. The chapter division is of man, it isn't of God. It should never have been divided there. Had that not occurred, had chapters properly been used, and very likely we're going to divide the Bible in such a way that there will be proper paragraphing in the modern sense to convey meaning that is now lost in this manner, then we would have understood it in part. But even if we had understood chapter 10 as an inset, we couldn't have understood its meaning, because there was a time before which this work was not involved in speaking to people and nations and tongues and kings, the kings being the important aspect of it. Now let's take a look at what Mr. Armstrong did or did not say in terms of clarity. When we understand this point, I think then the mystery of what he was saying will become clear. Now, he mentions that you must prophesy before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings, and then the two witnesses are introduced in chapter 11. Whose function is defined there, and when they have finished their testimony, they are killed, and they of the people and kindreds and tongues and nations, their leaders, as well, shall see their dead bodies, and then it ends with the resurrection and the return of Christ, as you will see as it goes on. Now, to speak before people and nations, tongues and kings, as the 12 who, the two witnesses, is what Mr. Armstrong said. Now, what he didn't say, and if you look carefully in the way that I suggested to Brian Knowles, we handle it as it will appear in the February issue of the Plain Truth, I guess it is. You will see a variation between the original letter, co-worker letter, November 19, and the article as it appears. I suggested to Brian Knowles that he italicize or capitalize one word in verse 11 of chapter 10, which I failed to read more than once to draw attention to it. He said to me, "You must prophesy again." And Mr. Armstrong failed to italicize or capitalize or emphasize that word again, which, had he done so, I think would have made it clear. "You must prophesy again before many peoples, nations, tongues, and kings," which presumes that if the two witnesses are to prophesy before kings again, they have done it before. That's clear. Now, if it is to be done by the two witnesses again, then it has been done before. Now, this was all done years ago in the person of John, maybe 95, 96 AD, in that period. And John, of course, being the apostle, the leading and only one of the 12 left at the time, is responsible for conveying to us the message and symbolically going through his own experience, having preached before peoples, nations, tongues, and kings prior to his imprisonment in the early 90s, I presume, by Domitian. When Domitian died in 96, he was released, and the implication he too would do it again. Now, if the two witnesses are to do it again, therefore it must also be done before. That is clear. If it isn't, there's some opacity in your own thinking. John makes it plain. Now, if this is to be done again by two witnesses who are next introduced, speaking before the world, and the whole world is upset by them, because, as I did not read, but you undoubtedly have read, "And they that dwell upon the earth will rejoice over them and make merry, because the two prophets tormented those that dwelt on the earth," so that everybody would knew what was being said sufficiently. And if the common people knew, the kings most certainly did. This would presume, therefore, that the tribulation, which parallels the first part of the 3.5 years referred to in chapter 11, the tribulation could not begin in 1972 because the church had not yet reached many peoples, nations, tongues, and kings, and that we did not understand. We did not grasp that there was a part of the work prior to 72 that hadn't been accomplished. Would to God it had been done by then, but it wasn't. That still needed to be before it's to be done again, in this case by two witnesses with supernatural power, because the church doesn't have the capacity in this world of tribulation and persecution with the Gentiles treading down the holy city to accomplish it as we do now. We can sit here in this Masonic temple. There's coming a time when there won't even be Masonic temples allowed. It is mine, and I think that would have clarified the whole problem. Completing the period of the history of the Church of God prior to the two witnesses, we have, of course, this reflected in the fact that there is the candlestick with seven branches, and then there are the two separate candlesticks which follow the two witnesses, that is. We should have recognized long ago that all seven stages of the church precede the two witnesses, and not that six lead up to 72, and thereafter the Laodicean state of mind pops up parallel with the tribulation. But that was our general picture because we didn't know how to account for such a state of mind of lukewarmness, a church that thinks it's spiritually rich and increased with goods and need of nothing, yet is miserable, poor, blind, and spiritually naked. Not a church labeled for heresy, but a church where the internal attitude is so fundamentally a problem that one might have described people in that state as inactive members. Never was there a time until now in the history of this experience in the church that we ever invent a category of inactive members. Every congregation now has a list of members who regularly attend and inactive members. I'll just let you interpret that as you will. Our inactive membership as reflected in the fact that in 1975 we had 85,000 registered people roughly for the Feast of Tabernacles and 75,000 this year is an indication that we have at least 10,000 inactive members who were not even active enough to register in the United States, which frankly was not clearly at rest in the worldwide news, where the intent was not to upset anybody. See, there wasn't time to at least shake ourselves to waken ourselves. And now we coddle ourselves and put ourselves to sleep. We used to ask ourselves if this was a problem before it really was. Now that it is, we want to run away from it. There was a time we would do something about inactive membership, and now it's just taken for granted because it is so prevalent. The fact is, Mr. Kleininger, if he had to take his time to pursue all the inactive members, wouldn't be feeding all the active ones. That's the state. I hope it isn't as bad here as elsewhere, but I know that if you have something like 90,000 people in the country, there are always some who are newly baptized who can't attend or some who cannot afford to have this percentage of plainly, openly inactive members without discussing the rest who are not that active who sit among us. We have certainly 20 to 30% of the people who are drifting with our rudder, who have lost their goal. And if we were to pass through a stage in which this particular problem defined at the Church of Laodicea would become characteristic of a growing number of people in our midst, partly because it's a characteristic of the world, the industrial, the economic world around us. Whether we like it or not, every period of the history of the Church of God parallels in some way the world around it. When a generation went through the First World War, the Great Depression, the Second World War, and the rise of communism all through this time, the Korean War, that put its stamp on individuals without any question and affected the thinking of 2 to 3 generations. There now is a growing element in the Church of God that grew up without the experience of the Depression, without the Great Depression, without the experience of the Second World War or the Korean War, that grew up, if you please, to the Eisenhower era later, the Kennedy-Johnson-Nixon era, the scandal of Watergate, the fiasco of Vietnam, the fact that we have downs in our economy, but there's always big government to do something about it. The fact that more and more people are taken care of by welfare, the fact that the standard of living is higher than it has really ever been, the fact that we have television reaching our homes more effectively than any ministry can, because you're attending church for 2 hours a week, you listen to television certainly hardly less than 2 hours a day if you're an abnormal family, and more if you're a normal family. And I guarantee you the thinking from television, newspapers, magazines, and or movies if you go, has a tremendous effect. The devil and God can reach into the homes of these media, but the devil is working, of course, overtime, as distinct from some in God's work. And therefore, many of us are affected by what we see coming into our home. We're affected by Watergate scandal and syndrome more than anything else, probably, in the last few years, in a way that can affect the Church of God because of mistakes, if you please, and sins within the church that were tolerated unnecessarily long. But God can forgive. The question is, can we get Watergate and problems like that out of our mind politically? Can we get it out of our mind internally in the church? Can we correct mistakes in the private lives of individuals? We have more people in the Church of God today as laymen, not excluding the ministry also, who are alcoholics, do not assume that instruct the ministry. We have those who smoke more and more openly. We know that there is a larger number than ever before who pop pills that don't just come from the drugstore. And when these things occur, and people can do these things without ever evaluating their effect, all of them as individuals, you will understand what the state of mind is. And so what we have to face is the fact that chapter 10, which is the background in chapter 11, is really telling us that the whole history of the church was to be completed before the two witnesses in terms of the work of seven candlesticks and not merely six. This explains, therefore, that when the angel cried, roared, verse 3 of chapter 10, expressing, if you please, what was in that little book, that certainly includes part or all of the Bible. The Bible, by comparison to all the literature that is written, is just a small document. This angel cried, spoke out with his little book in his hand, and there were seven thunders which uttered their voices, not six. And when the seven thunders uttered their voices, John was about to write what they said, and he was told to seal it up and write them not. And because we didn't have any explanation of what was said, we assumed this was all in the day of the Lord instead of being before the two witnesses. That's the point. The seven thunders are before the two witnesses, not in the day of the Lord, under the sixth trumpet, because this is all an inset. Now, when we recognize that indeed God thunders when he speaks, and he speaks to the church, and the church would be thundering God's message, and Time magazine spoke of Mr. Armstrong's voice as thundering God's message of the kingdom of God around the world. Thunder, of course, can be more or less noisy, depending on how near. Thunder can be distant and quiet. Thunder can be very close and shockingly loud. So the churches, through history, has spoken quietly or loudly. Certainly the Church of God has been speaking recently very loudly, as it did in the days of the Apostles, the later Roman Empire, and into the Middle Ages, even though the voice became very dulled and distant and muffled in the Sardis era of the Church, when it reached the birthright tribes who were so interested in their inheritance that religion didn't mean very much, it seems. What we have is a reference to the fact that God was speaking to the churches, seven voices, seven thunders. They're not recorded because, in fact, the message that the church gives is a message of the kingdom of God, which is already laid out in the Bible. And it certainly isn't necessary to explain all of the statements made in the churches with respect to the various political leaders. Why should we clutter up the book of Revelation with references to Charlemagne, to Otto the Great, previously to Justinian, and all the Roman Empire of that time, and Charles V, and Napoleon, and Mussolini, and Hitler? Those things we can learn when we meet the people in the resurrection who were used to speak to the world at that time and warn those nations, warn those leaders. But in any case, we move along. That when the voice of the seven thunders has been, the voices of the seven thunders have been uttered, then we are told that it'll all be over. There'll be no longer a delay or a postponement. That was terrible. But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, which is finally to come, which sounds beginning with verse 14 of chapter 11 of Revelation, then the mystery of God should be finished, which he has declared to his servants, the prophets, who've been speaking all along. And the voice which I heard from heaven spoke to me again, and then you have this little book which is to introduce, doing it through the two witnesses as distinct from the seven thunders. See, he carried a little book and there were seven thunders, then he has a little book again and there are two witnesses. The same basic message spoken seven times before in seven great periods. But what we have then is a clear indication that although the Church of God and its various spiritual states and stages should have been one, it hasn't always been. This work began years ago at a time when the Church was spiritually dead. Though it had a name, it was alive. You find like the first section of chapter 3, the Sardis congregation in Asia Minor. And this work that Mr. Armstrong and the Eugene Church of God did, from 1934 on, or the broadcast of Volume 3 in 1933, beginning in October, before we had to pay for it, the 1st of January in 1934, we worked side by side with the Church of God Seventh Day until 1938, when it was separated. That is, the Church of God Seventh Day expelled the living branch of the church in 1938, but before that it was side by side. That should be clear. Now today everybody is invited on the ship, whether you're lukewarm, whether you're spiritually hot or cold. Nobody wants to make a separation. And so we have two spirits and attitudes that are predominant today, as well as any others that could be in any individual. And it reflects the state of mind in the world today, where I can say plainly there are no standards, dress and grooming and conduct like the world used to have it. There are no standards to speak of in the church. You can go pretty far today and call yourself a Christian or a church member. I have the sad situation of dealing with some children that a minister and I are taking care of for the moment. We were waiting for the mother so I could, and the other minister could take the whole family to the dinner in an inexpensive place. So we started to walk to the place and the mother didn't return. And the little children spotted the car and then they looked for the mother and found her in a bar. She had left the children in the house without furniture from 2:30 to 6 o'clock when we left, and certainly would have left until 7, but these are the people we meet. Now, she hasn't been baptized. She's one of those who are near us, not yet among us, but it just gives an illustration of the problem. And there are people who bring some of these habits among in themselves when they come into the church, and it isn't all washed away in baptism. What we have today is the fact that all new broadcasts were terminated in 1971 in October, exactly 38 years after they began, two 19-year time cycles, interestingly enough. But from that time on, we have had all kinds of spiritual problems besetting the church that reflect a ferment and differences of attitude, so that people are working together in the same group, though we're not all comfortable with each other. We just have to face these things. Because a new spirit has become dominant. Mr. Armstrong's message was once essentially the key of David, referred to in the second phase of chapter 3 of Revelation. Today his message most certainly is the beginning of the creation of God, which is the way Christ appears to the congregation of Laodicea. We live in a world where that is clearly a dominating force in the home and private lives of any individual, unless we resist it. The doors were open to the Philadelphia era of God's church, as Mr. Herbert Armstrong has said, and that work is going on, but we have added a whole massive quantity of people who will compromise with the world, who do not use the Bible as the standard by which they judge what they do in terms of vanity and dress, grooming, makeup, birthdays, voting, intermarriage between the races, you name it. They use the world as the standard and not the Bible. And if the Bible doesn't expressly forbid something in the form of law, which is defined as sin when transgressed, then the assumption is we're not concerned with the examples of the Bible. We are only concerned with doing everything we want to do that God doesn't forcibly prevent us from doing. That's the state of most people in the world. And it is a growing state of mind in the church. We have gotten away from the implication of remaining unspotted from the world, and we have all kinds of people whose garments are very spotted, who are being pulled back from the fires of Gehenna. So bad it was that the imperial schools in Big Sandy, if you please, had a club for the girls for deflowering themselves. And you wonder God closed imperial schools there, where they were having more drugs, hard drugs, passed around in our own school than in the public schools, Rainwater and Big Sandy. And not until the school was closed did the public schools realize that we had any good kids at all, because the bad ones were being pumped into the public schools. And when the rest of them were sent to the public schools, they got the better picture of what the real character should have been. And administrators and parents were tolerating it, who knew what they were doing. And to him that knows to do good and does it not, it's sin. That, a reflection of the world that has come into God's church all too often. Now, hopefully, as Mr. Garnett said, Armstrong said, we can repent of that kind of thing that has been allowed in our midst. But it is a growing factor. I can guarantee to you that a larger and larger percentage of God's people are not going to attend the festivals. I know ministers today, high up in responsibility, when the Passover comes and they read about the breaking of the bread, they don't ever define what it is, because they don't believe God could heal them or anybody else. Or if they did, that's a matter of God's capricious act, not because Christ did anything, and they don't know why they're breaking the bread. They could just as well eat the whole loaf. That's how far it has grown. But of course, when Mr. Armstrong goes away, the mice will play, spiritually speaking. And Mr. Ted Armstrong is occupied in the great administrative functions of this work. After he had to learn certain lessons in his life in 1971 and 72, but he has to be away at public meetings in Canada and here, the mice will play. So, the 10th chapter in closing of Revelation is a picture of what God's church has been doing in public and in private, sometimes in a great tribulation of the Middle Ages. We have a situation where the church has had to speak, in a sense, underground, in the mountainous regions of the world and not in the great cities. And before and after that, it has most certainly spoken in public. We are now doing and continuing to do. The word picked up again. Mr. Armstrong, Mr. Rader, Mr. Fortune, and any number of others were pointing out that in 1972 a new era began. I didn't invent that word at that point. They used it. And indeed it has, and we're marching side by side. There's some of God's congregations who have heresy in them, like certain churches, Revelation 2 and 3. Some who lost their first love that I can name. Some who have retained it. Some who are spiritually dead. There are many who are dedicated to holding to the Word of God, and a growing number is becoming lukewarm. And that's going to be the dominant state. And men are not going to separate it because it can happen to you, it can happen to me, and that kind of attitude you cannot administer in the same way that you can administer outright doctrinal errors, outright sins. Laodicea is not a church full of sins in the sense of violations of the Ten Commandments as much as it is just compromising the Word of God and going as far to the world as you can. It's an attitude. And that's why the battle was given up by Mr. Armstrong when he was analyzing this problem of holding fast and permissiveness. And today the church may be characterized with more and more permissiveness. Parents no longer discipline their children. They no longer teach the children the Bible, and so we have introduced Sunday schools on the Sabbath to make up for the lack of that kind of training at home. And that's the state of affairs. We might as well wake up to the fact, and I'm speaking plainly. Parents no longer disciplined. Children participate on the Sabbath, Friday night, in sports. You'd be surprised how the dating habit has gone so far beyond our own fellowship. And there's little wonder, of course, that children date outside of the church, because most in the church are often worse than the responsible individuals outside when their parents haven't trained them. There are more people outside sometimes in certain areas who have withheld themselves from the world than certain families whose children have been allowed to become like the world years after the world perhaps had already passed through a phase. And wore short skirts in God's church in this country, for instance, after the world got longer because it never had a chance to have a short before. But we use makeup about 5 to 10 years after the world has passed through certain phases. But that's, of course, to be expected because they've always wanted to anyway, and they're only trying to catch up. Jesus Christ said he's going to deal with that kind of problem. He himself will have to spew them out and the tribulation will come. And those who remain faithful, God will protect. Not in the streets of New York and Los Angeles, but protect as he defines it in Revelation chapter 12. So what we have here in response to Mr. Armstrong's co-worker letter, which was not quite as clear as he certainly would have wanted it to be, It's a reference to the fact that he is doing a work now which is only a prelude yet that is to be done, and by two witnesses, and we're not told yet who they are. We may surmise who they are, as Mr. Armstrong once said. It could even be Billy Graham with one of them, but he'd have to be repentant and converted yet. So let us leave that to God's judgment. It is much wiser that he should decide who they are than the two of you should. You see, they're going to die, those two witnesses. So before you decide you want to be one of them, you want to count the cost. I want to thank Mr. Cloninger for giving me the opportunity. I wish all of you well, and I hope you will take note what God does make known through Mr. Herbert Armstrong in terms of what is going to be developing in the Middle East, the Mediterranean world. I would point out that one of the brethren, and some brethren do watch, and others watch hardly at all. One man called me up who mentioned something before. He said it is now in the news that the Roman Catholic Church, which has owned approximately a quarter of the investments in the city of Rome outside Vatican City, which is a separate state, is quietly selling its property. Rome is no longer declared a holy city. The church no longer has a special relationship established in 1929 by Mussolini. They are pulling out in their real estate investments in Rome and probably in other parts of Italy too. But I can guarantee you there's a city ultimately where they're going to reinvest and move to. It is not Moscow.